It is Wednesday, February 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we look at relations between the United States and Canada in the Trump era.
The new administration are giving access to Canada precisely because they feel Canada is one of the countries that they can deal with.
A Russian opposition leader is convicted of embezzlement, a ruling he disputes. And we find out why singer Adele is getting a lot of attention these days. It's all ahead. Two more Canadian officials, anxious about the direction of its most important neighbor and trading partner, are in Washington Wednesday trying to take the measure of the new administration of President Donald Trump. Finance Minister Bill Morneau and Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland are meeting with U.S. officials on trade and security matters, including their long border of nearly 9,000 kilometers. Canadian Defense Minister Harjit Singh Sajjan visited his American counterpart, James Mattis, Monday. Several Canadians attended Mr. Trump's inauguration, but no date has yet been set for a bilateral meeting between the U.S. President and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The Trump administration has indicated it plans to renegotiate the 23-year North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada. Canada sends 75% of its exports to the U.S. market. University of Toronto political science professor Nelson Wiseman tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Mr. Trump is viewed in Canada as very much of a wild card.
It's logical that Canadian officials are going there. I think officials from around the world want access to senior actors in the Trump administration. The message I read in between the lines is that the new administration are giving access to Canada precisely because they feel Canada is one of the countries that they can deal with and would allow Trump to say, you know, we have a partner we can make a good deal with in a number of areas, defense, trade, security. The Canadian-American relationship is very much like Siamese twins when it comes to the economy. I don't think any two economies in the world are as integrated. Canada is much more dependent in terms of its exports to the United States than the United States is dependent on its exports going to Canada.
What are the key points the Canadian officials hope to discuss with their American counterparts over the coming days?
On the defense file, Canada was intending, had made a commitment to the United Nations that it was going to send 600 troops to Mali and, in fact, lead that peacekeeping force in Mali. In light of the election of Trump, Canada has now suspended that decision and is looking for signals from the United States. And it looks to me like Canada is more willing to send additional troops to Europe. With respect to trade, Chrystia Freeland is a well-known name in the United States as a financial journalist. She lived in the United States for a good part of her life. Thus, she was elevated to becoming foreign minister, and the other foreign minister, the former one, a French-Canadian, Stéphane Dion, was replaced precisely because Canada felt that Freeland and the Americans would talk similar language, whereas Dion's orientation was more international, more oriented to Francophonie, more oriented to the United Nations. Another significant change was that a new MP, Andrew Leslie, who had extensive experience in the Canadian military and knows Mattis and has dealt with Mattis, and was promoted as a parliamentary secretary as a way of greasing the wheels for dealing with the American defense establishment.
Nelson Wiseman of the University of Toronto. Meanwhile, the UK publication The Independent said, as a result of changing U.S. immigration policies, a record number of refugees in the U.S. are fleeing to Canada. The group Welcome Place, a refugee agency in Manitoba, said it helped more than 90 people since November, many having braved wintertime conditions to avoid official border checks. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
Well, so a story that is getting a lot of attention here in the United States. Last night, as the nomination for Senator Sessions to be Attorney General was being debated, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren learned was reading from a few letters. One was from the late Senator Ted Kennedy, and the second was from the late Coretta Scott King, who's, of course, the widow of Martin Luther King Jr. Now, while she was reading the letter from Coretta Scott King, she was the majority leader. Senator Mitch McConnell got up to the floor. He objected, and he raised what's called Rule 19, which doesn't allow any one senator to quote, impugn the character, unquote, of any other senator. And, of course, Jeff Sessions is still a sitting senator. So there followed a moment or two, and she was basically silenced. She was forced to sit down and be quiet. And Senator McConnell defended this decision. When he spoke to the press a little bit later, he said, quote, "She was warned, she was given an explanation, nevertheless, she persisted." So the way social media works right now is if you say something like "she persisted," it is going to become a hot trending hashtag. And in fact, hashtag "she persisted" is the number one trending hashtag in the United States at the moment. And you're seeing all kinds of posts. Here's a picture of little Ruby Bridges, the little black girl. Remember back in Little Rock, I think it was.
Yes.
And she was being escorted out, during a forcible desegregation in the schools by, you know, all these Secret Service or whatever police officers they are. Here's Tammy Duckworth. She persisted. Let's see. Not my president. She resisted. She persisted. She didn't give in. Silencing Elizabeth Warren won't work because we are millions and millions. Here's photographs of Malala Yousafzai. Yeah, she persisted. Coretta Scott King, Anne Frank. I mean, everybody's just kind of, it's like saying, yeah, you know what? She persisted. That's not a bad thing. Now, I have been looking for people who are, trying to criticize or who are criticizing Senator Warren for, again, what the chair ruled was a violation of Senate Rule 19, impugning the character of a sitting senator. I've looked and looked and looked and looked, and I'm not finding anything. So there you go. Hashtag she persisted, a big one right now in the United States.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Doug. That is social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The former prime minister known as Farmajo wins Somalia's presidential election. Islamic State pamphlets in the Pakistan border areas are creating panic. Militants kill 6 employees of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Afghanistan. And the European Union could punish members that don't accept refugees. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Observations made by Mars probes have suggested that the planet once had an abundance of water flowing over its surface. But scientists have been left scratching their heads, wondering how this would be possible, considering the ancient sun was about one-third as warm as today. A popular theory proposes that the ancient Martian atmosphere was rich in carbon dioxide, which created a greenhouse effect that would have warmed the surface enough to allow liquid water to flow on the red planet. New findings from NASA's Mars Curiosity rover show that sedimentary bedrock from an ancient lake does not contain any carbonates. NASA researchers say this lack of carbonates suggests that the Martian atmosphere could not have held carbon dioxide when water was said to flow on Mars some 3.5 billion years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at reports of divisions in the Taliban. A Russian judge has declared opposition leader Alexei Navalny guilty of embezzlement, a decision that may prevent him from running in next year's presidential election. I spoke with VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf and asked him what statement the judge made in the case.
Very slowly and long-windedly. The court systems here in Russia, whenever they're handing down a sentence, they tend to go over all of the testimony and evidence in a summarized fashion, but it takes forever. So it was hours of reading off all of the details of the case before they finally announced the sentence. But in reading off all the details of the case early on, it became clear that it was going to be a guilty verdict. And then later on, that was affirmed some hours later when the judge finally said that he would be sentenced to a 5-year suspended prison term and a fine of around $8,000.
Well, and apparently Navalny expected this, I believe, going into the court appearance.
Oh, absolutely. And not just Navalny, although he very much expected it and is very active in social media here in Russia and was early on saying that he didn't expect anything good to come out of this, that he was quite sure that they were going to do everything they can, they being Russian authorities, to prevent him from his presidential bid. He announced in late December that he was going to be running for the highest office in Russia, the president of Russia, in 2018 when we have elections coming up here, which is expected by everyone to be a direct challenge to President Vladimir Putin, although President Putin has not announced officially that he will be running again. Most people expect that he will because there are no other candidates or challengers other than Navalny. And this court's verdict, finding him guilty of fraud involving a case that stretches back a few years ago, is going to prevent him from being able to run, because according to Russian law, if you have been found guilty, even if it is a suspended sentence, you are not allowed to run for president. So right now, Navalny's team is preparing to challenge this in court. They're going to appeal, and Navalny himself and others around him have said that they are still going to push forward with his plan to run for president. But if they do not get this verdict overturned, then legally, according to Russian law, he cannot run for president, and there is nobody else who has announced any intention to oppose President Putin.
What has the reaction been like in Russia to this conviction?
Well, certainly it did get some coverage in the media because he is a fairly high-profile opposition leader. He's the most high-profile opposition leader in Russia right now. He was instrumental in pushing forward with protests against President Putin and the Kremlin in 2011, 2012, the largest protests against Putin to ever take place. And he also ran for mayor in Moscow and came in second with a little over a quarter of the votes. So he does have a support base in Moscow and in St. Petersburg and other big cities. And certainly the media in large cities are aware of him, and they do cover some of these activities, the fraud, multiple number of fraud cases that have been launched against him, efforts by authorities to keep him under house arrest, to prevent him from participating in politics. So there is attention being given to it. But of course, in the state-run television, state-run media, of course, is very slanted. They don't really challenge the idea that this court case, that the verdict may have been less than free and fair, which if you talk to political analysts here in Moscow and certainly Kremlin watchers, there was very little, practically nothing that was free and fair about this case against him. The retrial that took place, as Navalny himself pointed out, when the verdict was being read, it was practically the exact same verdict that was handed down by a previous trial in 2013. Now, that trial's verdict had been overturned by the European Court of Human Rights. And the Russia Supreme Court upheld the European Court of Human Rights overturning that. So this retrial has now effectively overturned the European Court of Human Rights, which is quite astounding.
That's VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Civilian casualties in Afghanistan rose to a new high in 2016 amid the ongoing Taliban insurgency, with 3,500 killed and close to 8,000 wounded, according to the UN. But a new analysis suggests the Taliban is deeply divided, with high levels of dissatisfaction among the rank and file. Henry Ridgewell reports.
In Kabul and other cities in Afghanistan, a wave of suicide attacks continues to exact a brutal toll. UN Special Representative Tadamichi Yamamoto told reporters Monday that 2016 had seen a record number of casualties.
The killing and maiming of thousands of Afghan civilians is deeply harrowing and largely preventable.
Yet despite the violence, some analysts say there are opportunities for peace. A study based on dozens of interviews with Taliban insiders suggests exploiting fractures within the group. Professor Theo Farrell of the Royal United Services Institute is co-author of the report.
Senior commanders who were, in a sense, using suicide attacks to build up their reputation. So there are large parts of the Taliban that are fully committed to the fight. But there is a potential here, nonetheless, to de-escalate the conflict.
That potential, according to Farrell, lies in the weakness of the Taliban's leadership.
The new emir, Akhundzada Habibullah, is widely seen as a weak and divisive leader. Many of our interviewees refer to him as simply a symbolic leader. The real power in the Taliban lies elsewhere. And so, therefore, there's a view among the rank and file that effectively the movement has become leaderless.
Informal peace talks have taken place between the government and the Taliban leadership, but senior Taliban commanders have demanded the 13,000 NATO-led foreign troops in Afghanistan withdraw before formal talks begin. Speaking in December, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani blamed the continuing bloodshed on Pakistan for failing to take on militant groups in its territory, a charge denied by Islamabad.
Some still provide sanctuary, in support, or tolerate these networks. As Mr. Kakazadeh, one of the key figures in the Taliban movement, recently said, if they did not have sanctuary in Pakistan, they would not last though a month.
Farrell argues the senior Taliban leadership should be circumvented, enabling dissenting commanders to meet and forge a common purpose of ending the conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. British singer Adele is getting a lot of attention these days, and Border Crossing's host Larry London joins me with all the details.
There's just so much to talk about whenever it comes to Adele. Let's see, where shall we start? How about the Super Bowl? Let's start there first. Adele was originally approached to perform the halftime show at the Super Bowl, which was performed by Lady Gaga on Sunday night. And she turned it down because she said the halftime show at the Super Bowl is not about music. She said it's more of a show. And if you've ever seen Adele, she said it's not really a show that I do. I sing songs. I'm a singer. And that's kind of where she's from. She said I don't dance. Mm-hmm. I don't have special effects. That's just not my thing. So she didn't think she'd be the proper choice for the Super Bowl halftime show. So she told the NFL no thank you. But she did send out a tweet and said, Lady Gaga, you smashed it, totally nailed it. So apparently she approved of Lady Gaga's performance during the Super Bowl show. Now, other things about Adele. She is going to be performing at the Grammys this coming up Sunday. She was at last year's Grammys. And, of course, she's nominated for a handful of Grammys because of her recent album 25, which is her third album. And I guess it's sold over 10 million copies. So once you hit the 10 million sales mark, they kind of stop counting. It's just been on the charts an amazing 63 weeks. Right now, her album 25 is at number 23 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. And she is currently on tour and will continue touring. Apparently, according to the Grammys, she is the highest paid act at the Grammys on tour. $80.5 million. $80.5 million is what she made in 2016. And she averages about $3.8 million per city on her tour, in addition to the album sales. So Adele is doing well enough to turn down $50 million in endorsement deals. She's been offered commercials and endorsements, and she said, no, I'm not going to do that. Why? Not that she's got enough money, but she's going to do it because she wants to be a mom. And she said, I want to protect my relationship with my children. I want to spend time with my kids. I don't want to be recording TV commercials all the time. So she's got a 4-year-old son whose name is Angelo. On a recent tour stop, she told the audience she wants to have a second child as soon as the tour, you know, finishes. There was a rumor that she had wed her longtime boyfriend, Simon Konecki, but so far no word on whether that's confirmed or not. That's just kind of floating around out there. But today we're going to listen to the latest single from Adele, and this is the 4th song from the album 25. This one's called Water Under the Bridge.
If you're not the one for me, then I'll come, I can bring you to your knees. If you're not the one for me, why do I hate the idea of being...
I think I'd also read that Adele has purchased a home in the Hollywood Hills.
She's got homes everywhere. When you make $80.5 million a year, you can have a home wherever you want to have a home. And, you know, she was spotted a couple weeks ago grocery shopping by herself. She didn't have the makeup on. She just went out and said, thought she'd be just a regular person and just go grocery shopping. So, of course, the paparazzi found her and took photos of her, but she looked like any... You probably would walk past her down the produce aisle, and you'd never know that's Adele. So, yeah, she wants to lead as regular a life as she can, given that she's a superstar, known around the world. But, yeah, I mean, she's got a house in Beverly Hills. She lives in the United States. She also has homes back in England, where she's originally from. She leads a very simple life. She drives, one of the cars she has is a Cooper, a Mini Cooper. She drives a little car, so she's not into being picked up by limos and driving Porsches and Jaguars. She just kind of keeps it simple, which is very nice, and she just wants to live that kind of a lifestyle and stay grounded. We'll see her on the Grammy show. She's up against a lot of different performers for the biggest award of the day, the Album of the Year, which is a title she won at last year's Brit Award show, the Album of the Year for 25. She also last year got the Brit Award for the Song of the Year for Hello. She's nominated for a handful. She'll be up against Beyoncé at this year's Grammys on Sunday night. So we shall see. Will it be Adele? Will it be Beyoncé? Who will it be? We'll find out.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing.
Is he gonna let me down, let me down?
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the recent spike in violence in eastern Ukraine around Avdiivka. Since January 28th, the Special Monitoring Mission of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, has reported a dramatic increase in fighting in eastern Ukraine, including attacks with weapons banned by the Minsk agreements, signed in 2014 and 2015. The fighting has caused dozens of Ukrainian military casualties and at least 50 civilian casualties. It has also left approximately 17,000 civilians, including 2,500 children, without water, heat, or electricity. The UN Security Council expressed its grave concern over the dangerous deterioration in eastern Ukraine and called for an immediate return to a ceasefire regime. Security Council members also expressed their full support of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. Nearly 10,000 people, more than half of them civilians, have been killed in Ukraine since the fighting erupted in the spring of 2014, when the Russian military moved to occupy Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea was preceded by months of pro-Western protests in Ukraine's capital of Kiev, which ultimately prompted Ukraine's pro-Russian president to abandon his position and flee the country. In response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine, the United States, the EU, and a number of other countries applied targeted sanctions against Russian individuals, businesses, and officials. These sanctions remain in effect nearly 3 years later. To avert a larger humanitarian crisis, the United States calls for an immediate, sustained ceasefire and full and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. The U.S. also reaffirms its support for full implementation of the Minsk agreements to end the violence in eastern Ukraine and calls for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea.
That was an editorial reflecting the view